Morning, judges. I'm Robert Gallenbeck. I represent Clenard Gary Lambert. Before I start my argument, what I want to do is incorporate my brief in my argument in toto, and I'll try not to repeat myself as much as I can. Mr. Lambert was convicted by a jury of the Circuit Court of Russell County of two counts. One was driving under the influence of drugs. The second one was maliciously causing the death of another while driving under the influence of drugs. He was sentenced on both of those. Our first assignment of error has to do with the judges not allowing us to introduce certain factors pertaining to the arresting officer and the fact that that he had been arrested on a misdemeanor, had been put on suspension.
But on that, at the time of trial, he had neither been terminated nor convicted, correct?
Correct.
Under what provision of 2607, I believe, would you contest that this comes in?
We don't actually think that this is in the nature of trying to introduce evidence that a person is lying. Okay? And we say...
It's not a crime of moral turpitude. Yes.
I mean, right.
What type of character evidence are
okay.
you saying?
We tried to show during the case that he did not follow state police protocol. And we've shown several occasions where he did not follow state police protocol. Our purpose, and this is at appendix page 46, was not to show that the officer was lying. It was to show, again, that he did not follow state police protocol, number one.
Did he basically concede that when he said he didn't have an accident investigator arrive?
But he said he could do it himself. He said he didn't need the accident reconstructionist. We went through several things he didn't do, and we think that the jury was entitled to know that he flagrantly violated state police policy, including not giving his improper name to the arresting officer, and also by telling the officer who arrested him that he was not a police officer.
Mr. Gallenbach, we fortunately now, at least for judges' sake, have rules of evidence. Could you point to me the specific rule of evidence that you were relying on in offering this evidence?
There is none.
So if there is, the general rule is character evidence is not admissible to prove conduct. So if there is no exception, doesn't that general rule apply?
We don't believe it does because we're talking about the police officer here. We're talking about exculpatory evidence.
There's no separate rule of evidence dealing with a police officer versus any other witnesses.
Understand that. And we would ask the court to make that separate rule, especially where we're dealing with
rules of evidence here.
I understand, Judge.
We abide by rules of evidence.
I understand, Judge. But also, it is exculpatory evidence.
It goes
towards whether this officer, not even character, but as to whether or not he flagrantly violates police policy.
Wait, except his arrest and subsequent termination related to the arrest doesn't show us anything about what he did in this particular case because those issues are unrelated. I mean, he may also have violated the snow tire policy of the state police, but that has nothing to do with the investigation he conducted. In this case, does it?
No, it doesn't, but it does show that he
doesn't
does.
There have to be some sort of nexus between the two, even if we can get over the first hurdle of there's no rule that would allow this?
Don't believe there has to be other than the fact that this shows a very flagrant abuse.
Mr. Gallenbach, I don't mean to tell you how to argue your case, but you've got two other assignments of error here,
yes.
And I really would like to hear about those
okay.
as well, so I don't want you to use all your time on this.
Yeah, I was hoping that as well, Judge. Our second assignment of error is that the Commonwealth failed to prove that the drugs were self-administered by Mr. Lambert. In 2007, the Jackson case occurred, and in that, the court held that self-administration of the drug was part of the crime.
Would self-administer include allowing somebody else to inject you if you voluntarily allowed that to happen?
Okay, you're talking about the heroin case.
I'm assuming the
case that they brought up. No, sir, I think if you're involved in an illegal activity and you have an agent that you're directing to put the shot in your arm, that's your agent and you are not, it is self-administered at that point. But the Commonwealth has to prove that.
Well, I guess my question becomes, if, as you read self-administered as a requirement, short of a confession or a videotape, how would you ever prove that somebody was intoxicated by manner of self-administration as opposed to have been slipped a Mickey?
How would you ever prove specific intent? You have to do it by circumstantial evidence or otherwise. You have to question witnesses. The officer could have gone back. This is a homicide case.
But I've gone to a medical clinic for treatment that I know the effects of the drugs and voluntarily present myself for treatment. Why isn't that self-administration?
For the same reason that it wasn't in the Jackson case. He presented himself for treatment for pain. He got a narcotic. He also got fenugreek. He was told what the results would be. He was specifically asked whether he had a ride home and said he did. He lied and then went out and drove. It would be self-administered under the court's theory when he went in for pain and asked for relief from the pain.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, sir, if you were still answering the question. I just have a question. In this case, it was more than just the methadone that was found in his
correct
blood.
But there was no evidence presented by the Commonwealth that any of the drugs were self-administered.
Except, didn't he say that he had taken a Xanax or sports to that effect?
He never said that. And when he was asked the question by the officer, I believe the officer is, "What have you taken any? Not have you been given any drugs?" Now, there's no evidence in the record to show that any of the drugs were self-administered. And the Commonwealth says at page 17 of their brief that we're asserting that the drugs were not self-administered. We're not asserting that. We're asserting that the Commonwealth has to prove that they were self-administered and has not done that. They go into, I'd ask the court to look specifically at the brief as to the reasons we say that the drugs were not self-administered, including the fact that Dr. Kuhlman said that the drugs could be administered by injection or other ways and that he could not say how they were administered and the evidence that could have been presented. The officer never even made an attempt in the 5 months to talk to Lambert afterwards before he was charged. He could have done that. The Commonwealth says there's an exception that under Mayhew, the burden is on us. We disagree. Mayhew has 4 points to it. The first three all say exception to the statute. Here, this is not an exception to the statute. In fact, in Jackson, the court said, "We hold that the meaning of this phrase is clear. Narcotic drug in the operator of the motor vehicle is under the influence, must be self-administered."
The Commonwealth makes the argument, and it has some merit, that this is an affirmative defense. And if it's an affirmative defense, then the defendant has the burden of going forward with the evidence. Why isn't that argument valid?
Under Mayhew, and that's the case they cite, there are four factors. They're all conjunctive. And the first three factors say exception, when there's an exception stated in the statute. This is not an exception.
But what about the factor that said the information could be known only by the defendant, or is likely to only be known by the defendant?
But they're in the conjunctive.
But how would you ever prove how any drug was administered if it were done, you know, in private?
How
does the Commonwealth ever bear that burden?
The case, okay, in talking about exceptions, if you look at a section like 250, 18.2, 250, it says you can't be in possession of drugs. But then it says unless by prescription. That's what an exception is. And Mayhew makes it clear that it has to be an exception. Here, it's not an exception. And as to whether it's hard, if you look back at cases like Melendez-Diaz, you know, Judge Scalia said, yeah, it's going to be hard, but that's the law. You have to do it.
18.2-263 specifically says it's unnecessary to negate any exception in any complaint, information, indictment, action, et cetera, et cetera. It shall not be necessary to negative any exception, excuse, proviso, or exemption contained in the article. And this is effectively an exemption. It may not say exempt, but it is.
Not according to the ruling by the Supreme Court, well, when they said...
In Hart versus Commonwealth, we dealt with the issue, and we held that the Commonwealth didn't have to prove, what was it? It had to do with the earnings from a prostitute, I believe. But it was because it would only be known by the defendant, we said that was an affirmative defense.
But under Mayhew, you still have the three rules that it has to be an exception. It is not stated as an exception. And Judge, it's not supposed to be easy to find a defendant guilty of a homicide.
Possible.
It is possible. All this officer had to do was talk to the defendant, interview the defendant in the time he had. The Commonwealth made
no... And if the defendant declines to talk to him, it's not provable. Unless you have a videotape.
Except by circumstantial evidence. And they didn't even make an attempt to do that by calling someone from the clinic to say what they how they administer drugs. They could have done that.
You are into your rebuttal. You can reserve continue as you wish.
Thank you.
Ms. Yates, I want to ask you about your reliance on the affirmative defense and Mr. Gallenbach's suggestion that it's not supposed to be easy to convict someone. In order to use the results of a blood or breath test, the Commonwealth has to prove in an accident case that the defendant had not had any alcohol or consumed any alcohol between the time of driving and the time of testing. And often in these cases, the defendant sits there, you know, for a period of time waiting for the police to arrive. Isn't that a similar situation? The only way they could really prove it is to ask the defendant, and that is a requirement.
First of all, may it please the court, Rachel Yates on behalf of the Commonwealth. And to answer your question, there is a similar burden that the Commonwealth would need generally to prove a violation of this statute, that the defendant did consume an intoxicating substance prior to driving. So,
but I mean, yeah. I'm using that as an analogy to the self-administered issue. It is difficult to prove, I agree, but we have other instances where it is as difficult and generally is established by questioning of the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor. What I would say about this particular issue is that in nearly all circumstances, it would be impossible for the Commonwealth to gain evidence about how someone administered their intoxicants prior to driving. It's more than that for this particular statute.
If it's not an affirmative defense, can you still win based on reasonable inferences?
In this case, yes, Your Honor, given this record.
What reasonable inferences do you rely on?
So in this case, what we have is an accident that occurs, and there's mayhem at the accident scene, which I think is fair under the circumstances of the injuries. But the point that is important here is the fact that when the nurse and the officer both initially question Mr. Lambert denies having consumed anything. It's only later that he changes his statement and says, actually, I just came from a methadone treatment clinic. So we start from that point, taking his statement and using it against him. Mr. Lambert basically excludes that possibility that he raises on appeal, that it would be possible for him to have consumed something after the time of the accident before that point. From there, Mr. Lambert is taken via ambulance, and there is testimony from ambulance personnel that he was not given these intoxicating substances by them. Then he is taken to the hospital, and there's an agreed stipulation that the hospital didn't give him those intoxicating substances. So in this case, in this record, there is sufficient evidence that he consumed these substances prior to getting behind the wheel.
Well, right, but my question is that in and of itself, the fact that they weren't administered to you after you didn't consume them after you drove, But is the mere fact that they're in your system sufficient to give rise to a reasonable inference that it was self-administered?
And I apologize, I got sidetracked. The mere fact might be a different case, but we have more than that here. And that's because Mr. Lambert says, I went to a methadone treatment clinic and I obtained a treatment.
Well,
so
that, let me ask you about that.
Yes, sir.
In Jackson, it simply says the nurse administered the Dilaudid. It doesn't really say, was this a shot? Was this a pill that was given to the defendant to swallow? So isn't this just as much a administered by someone else as the facts in Jackson?
No, and I'll explain why. Because in Jackson, no one disputed whether the items were self-administered or not. They took that as a given. The only issue in that case was the statutory construction issue. And the record is otherwise fairly sparse about the exact circumstances because no one disputed it. Specifically, what we don't have in Jackson is anyone explaining what Mr. Jackson consented to in terms of hospital treatment. He may have been unconscious when it was given to him. So in terms of accepting or consenting to this treatment in Jackson, there's just not much development of the record.
Is it your position that if the nurse hands him a pill and a glass of water and he swallows the pill, that is not self, or that is self-administered?
That is self-administered, yes, sir.
But if the nurse sticks him with a needle and injects him with a substance, that is not self-administered?
It would be self-administered if he consented to the administration of that drug. It's an interesting statutory construction issue in this case, in that this statute, this language that we're discussing in the statute was added, I think, in 1928. Mm-hmm. And it's just now coming to a point where individuals are questioning what that means. But clearly the intent of the General Assembly was not to allow individuals who have intoxicating substances to be able to drive just because there's no evidence from prior to the driving about how they became intoxicated.
Basically, I shouldn't be allowed to get out of the DUI because it was by keg stand and therefore somebody else was pushing on the plunger of the keg.
Exactly. That is clearly not the intent of the General Assembly. I think what the General Assembly most likely is concerned about, the only reasonable concern that would lead to this language, is the idea that someone doesn't know they've been given something intoxicating and they don't want to felonize someone or convict them of a misdemeanor if they aren't aware that something happened.
Jackson's
That's the self-administered.
Jackson's been on the books a long time. As a matter of fact, I happen to be the Commonwealth attorney that lost Jackson, or at least my office did. So I know it's been there for a while, and the General Assembly has not bothered to do anything about it. Don't we then assume the General Assembly agrees with the Supreme Court's interpretation?
Well, there is no issue with Jackson, because I think the General Assembly would say the answer is clear. It's an affirmative defense, and no one has raised that particular issue.
We presume they read our opinions, but I'm not sure that's always the case.
Yes, sir. In terms of this particular case, however, I would note for the court that there is a jury instruction that does indicate that the Commonwealth accepted the burden in this case. And I would point that out to the court. I do think that impacts this particular case and the opinion this court might issue as to that. That being said, it is the Commonwealth's position that because of Mr. Lambert's statements, in addition to the fact that Mr. Lambert had other drugs in his system, that it's even more egregious than just operating with methadone. Those illegal drugs, I believe.
Well, does his statement that I didn't take anything, that I consumed no drugs, of course, the subsequent blood tests demonstrates that that's not true when he comes up with a story about where at least the method he took a methadone treatment. He changes his story. Is it sufficient to allow the trier of fact to say he lied about it and that gives me a basis for concluding he self-administered?
Yes. A reasonable fact finder could determine that Mr. Lambert lied to conceal evidence of his guilt. In addition, just as an irregular simple possession conviction, it's incumbent on the defendant to produce evidence that someone does have a valid prescription. So the fact finder could determine this person, Mr. Lambert, illegally had both Xanax and the remains of Valium in his system as well. And from that, it's certainly not lawfully administered by someone else. It would be reasonable to conclude it was self-administered in this case. So under these facts, there is sufficient evidence.
I want to ask you about the last assignment of error. Do you read that to be a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence that these drugs affected his ability to drive or operate a motor vehicle safely, or do you read that as being a challenge to evidence that the drugs were administered prior to the accident?
I read that as a challenge to the sufficiency as to timing specifically.
Timing only.
Yes, sir. And I believe I briefly answered that unintentionally, was attempting to answer another question, but I'm happy to go over those facts again if the court has a specific question about that third assignment of error. And as to the first assignment of error, I will rely on my brief if the court doesn't have questions about Trooper Osborne's extrajudicial conduct otherwise. And would otherwise rely on my brief, and I would ask the court to affirm in this case.
Thank you. Mr. Gallenbeck, can I ask you about that last assignment of error?
What timing?
Timing only.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
To clear up a question by Judge Russell, it wasn't after they found drugs in his system that the defendant said he'd gone to the methadone clinic. He said that at the scene. But that was when he was...
After an initial denial.
After an initial denial to the question, have you taken anything, which generally means have you taken any pills or anything like that. And later when the officer came back, he tried to clarify that.
Right, but where we are, of course, is, although that's one reading of taken, if there's another reading of taken, that benefits the Commonwealth, don't we have to give them that inference? Given the standard of review that they were the prevailing party at trial.
I don't think so. When you go back and you look at, you know, his statement, just that he told them voluntarily that he'd been to the clinic. I don't think so. And I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever of how these drugs were administered. And the court in Jackson said, must be self-administered. They didn't leave that up to question. And they don't make it an exception. And if you look at the rule as set forth by the Commonwealth from Flanagan, it is in the conjunctive. So the mere fact that it's solely within the knowledge of the defendant does not make it something that becomes an affirmative defense. It's not an exception. It's not stated as a however in the statute.
Do you agree that Jackson does not address what self-administered means?
Yes, sir.
So we could interpret that phrase to mean something other than actually administered by, that a situation where the defendant voluntarily allows or consumes the drug, we could interpret that to be self-administered.
Yes, but in this case you have no evidence of that whatsoever, because even Dr. Coleman said there were different ways to administer these drugs. They could be injected. The Commonwealth made no effort to get someone from the clinic there. If they'd gotten someone from the clinic there, they may have been able to prove how the drug was administered, that he took the pill. Here you have no evidence of that whatsoever. They have some burden. Even if it's small, they have some burden. And there is nothing here indicating that these drugs were self-administered. Nothing in the record whatsoever.
Does the initial false statement give rise to an inference of lying to conceal guilt?
No, sir.
Why not?
Because you don't know when he may not have known that drug was still in his system. He may not have taken it just before the accident. He may have taken it the day before, or he may have been given it the day before. Even Dr. Coleman says he cannot say when these drugs had been administered. Now, if you were to be stopped and you'd taken a Xanax yesterday and the officer asked you, have you taken any drugs, you're likely to tell him what you took that day or what happened that day, not what happened the day before. So it's not necessarily a lie. If you are asked by an officer after being stopped, how much did you have to drink? you're not likely to tell him what you drank the night before or the day before, which could have affected your level of intoxication. You're likely to say what you had just done. So I don't think it can be inferred that that's a lie at all based on the totality of the evidence in the case.
All right. Thank you very much for
your
argument. We'll greet counsel, and then we'll take up Marshall versus Commonwealth.